Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, December 14, 2017. A senior UN diplomat says the international community has an obligation to protect civilians in South Sudan.
If the state is unwilling to protect its populations against atrocity, or it is a party to the conflict and involved in committing atrocities, the region and the international community have equal responsibility to intervene.
And the Troika issues another strong warning to the government of South Sudan.
All parties to the conflict must participate constructively in this high-level revitalization forum in a spirit of compromise and inclusion. All parties must engage sincerely and make concessions in the national interest. Otherwise, the conflict and suffering will continue.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. This week marks 4 years of conflict in South Sudan. The UN Secretary General's Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, is defending the performance of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS. The UN Security Council authorized the 12,000-strong UN peacekeepers with a robust mandate of civilian protection following an outbreak of deadly violence in South Sudan's capital in December 2013. Dieng says there is a need to educate South Sudanese on the mandate of UNMISS.
I should say that the primary responsibility to protect the civilian population lies indeed with the state. It is by discharging this obligation that the state can demonstrate its sovereignty. When the state is unable to protect its populations, it has a responsibility to seek assistance from the neighbors, region, and the international community to discharge that responsibility. It is in this context that the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, the African Union, the United Nations, the Troika, and the international community at large assist South Sudan to end the conflict and to protect its population. But at the same time, if the state is unwilling to protect its populations against atrocity crimes, by which I mean genocide, crimes against humanity, war crime, ethnic cleansing, or it is a party to the conflict and involved in committing atrocities, the same neighbors, the region, and the international community have equal responsibility to intervene to protect the populations. It is untenable to do nothing. Never again should not be just another rhetorical call, but a commitment that should be followed through.
Let's pick it from never again. You went to Yei and you spoke very strong about what you saw in Yei. Yei is 100 miles from Juba, where the UN peacekeepers are. Why are civilians still going through what you saw in Yei when the UN is on the ground with a mandate to protect civilians?
The expectation, for instance, that 12,000 peacekeepers can provide physical protection throughout a country as vast as Texas. I mean, you are in the United States, and with a 12 million population, is completely unrealistic. I mean, the performance of peacekeepers cannot be measured against such world expectation or an unrealistic mandate. I mean, UNMISS is neither an intervention nor an interposition force. It can only operate with the consent of the host government. Therefore, it is of utmost importance that the government of South Sudan cooperates with UNMISS for the mission to discharge its Security Council mandate. We continue to receive reports of obstruction, both operational and administrative impediments to UNMISS, limiting the missions to perform its core task. It is important that the government guarantees free movement of the peacekeepers and cooperate to enable full development of the RPF. I mean, the RPF will enable UNMISS to reassign troops currently in Juba and extend its reach to populations in remote areas that equally and urgently require protection, including facilitating humanitarian delivery to those in dire need of assistance. And that is why I said we cannot blame the UN on the ground. I mean, they have been doing really what
talking about the RPF, since the Security Council mandated an additional deployment of troops to South Sudan, the people of South Sudan are still waiting to see the full deployment of RPF. What are the issues? People are dying, and why the delay?
We should understand that even if you had 50,000 more troops, that is not what's going to resolve the problem. I think the problem lies really with the government of South Sudan, which has the primary responsibility. And in that regard, I think it is important to say that we have seen atrocities. You referred, for instance, about the situation in Ye. Therefore, my view, what is needed today is to make sure that the victims of this conflict in South Sudan get legal redress. I mean, I was in Addis Ababa early this year, and I have been, as you may know, very supportive of the establishment of the hybrid court, and that is why I do believe that the African Union Hybrid Court, which is one of the institutions established under the agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, and as we all know, the implementation of the peace agreement was derailed with the renewed fighting in July 2016. And I think since then it has almost stalled. And fighting continues in many parts of the country, including attacks against civilians with impunity. Whereas I recognize the primacy of peace, it is very important and urgent that we address the impunity gap in South Sudan, which is partly contributing to the cycle of deadly violence.
That's Adama Dieng, UN Secretary General's Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide. He was speaking with me from Dubai yesterday. In second part of our interview tomorrow, Dieng talks about the African Union Hybrid Court. The Troika countries are calling on the government of South Sudan to negotiate in good faith at the high-level revitalization forum scheduled to kick off in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa this week. In a joint statement released Wednesday, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway say the humanitarian and security situation in South Sudan is unbearable and must not be allowed to continue. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Juba.
The humanitarian, economic, security, human rights, and political situation continues to deteriorate with devastating consequences for the people of South Sudan.
That's Mark Weinberg, public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Juba, who notes that over half of the population now lacks enough food to feed themselves, and a third of the population has fled their homes, making South Sudan the largest refugee crisis in Africa. The Troika says it fully expects the government of South Sudan to adhere to its repeated public and private commitments to participate in the high-level revitalization forum in good faith. Weinberg says the immediate goal is to stop the fighting.
It is our view as the Troika, so the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway, that all parties to the conflict must participate constructively in this high-level revitalization forum in a spirit of compromise and inclusion. All parties must engage sincerely and make concessions in the national interest. Otherwise, the conflict and suffering will continue.
The Troika countries also say the forum, which is scheduled to kick off on Monday in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, is a unique opportunity to make progress towards peace. The U.S., Britain, and Norway are also calling on the opposition to come to the table without preconditions. Weinberg says all parties must commit to the forum and not try to undermine it in any way.
We view the high-level revitalization forum as the essential inclusive forum to advance peace, and any other efforts in forum must support this effort, not run counter to it.
And the Troika countries say it is critical that IGAD countries put their individual interests aside and work together for peace in South Sudan. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwey told reporters in Juba yesterday that the Council of Ministers discussed the report prepared by IGAD Special Representative Ismail Wise, which reflects the opinions and aspirations of South Sudanese who say the upcoming forum must be inclusive. Makwe says the government is ready to attend the upcoming IGAD Council of Ministers meeting, which will set the agenda for the revitalization forum.
The cabinet was briefed, and the cabinet gave the okay to the delegation that will be going to attend the meeting of the Council of Ministers, as well as attending the forum at a later stage. The report was approved, it was adopted, and passed.
In its statement, Norway, the US, and UK vowed to fully support IGAD's continuing effort to build peace in South Sudan, saying they view the revitalization forum as essential toward advancing peace in the country. Tomorrow marks 4 years since the outbreak of fighting in South Sudan in 2013. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The chairman of the SPLM in opposition, Riek Machar Teny, is appealing to IGAD to allow him to attend the high-level revitalization forum in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa next week. Machar has been under house arrest in South Africa for several months. In a letter dated December 14 and addressed to the Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn, who is also the IGAD chairman, Machar said he has been prohibited from communicating with the outside world. Machar also requested Desalegn to allow the SPLM-IO Political Bureau and Military Command to hold its meeting in Addis Ababa next week. IGAD previously invited the SPLM-IO to take part in the talks and asked Machar to send 3 delegates to the forum. Machar's letter, which South Sudan in Focus obtained a copy, proposed a team of 32 people to attend the talks. The 32 includes Angelina Teny, Henry Odwar, and Elias Nyamlil, who will represent SPLM-IO at the forum. Machar also noted in the letter what he describes as IGAD's hostility towards his party, adding that high-profile abductions and harassment of his party members has been happening under IGAD's watch. Machar reiterated his party's commitment to reviving the 2015 peace deal, saying that it is the only way to restore peace in South Sudan. While refugee camps like Kakuma are a last resort for people fleeing violence and food insecurity, new research reveals that economic opportunities around the camp have been stimulated by the presence of refugee population. Ayen Bure reports research shows jobs created by presence of refugees has helped those living in and around the camp.
A team of economists and researchers studied Kakuma refugee camp to try to figure out what impact the camp has had on its surrounding community. One of those researchers, Jennifer Alex Garcia, an economist at Oregon State University and lead author of the study, says the data shows the camp has had a positive impact on locals.
Right next to the camp, so within 10 kilometers of distance, if the refugee population increases by about 10%, that corresponds to an increase in income of about 5.5%.
Alex Garcia says the positive impact largely has to do with the increase in wage and agricultural employment opportunities, as well as growth in livestock prices triggered by increased demand from the camp's refugee community.
When you look at what households are doing around the camp, you see that some of them are able to gain employment by going into the camp and either selling stuff or having stores outside the camp. Some of them are able to sell their animals to the camp, or the meat from their animals and the milk from their animals to the camp, and some of them are able to sell agricultural products. So through those different mechanisms, you see that there are kind of obvious ways in which production around the camp has been stimulated by the presence of the refugees.
The most common business operated by households around Kakuma is motor taxi services and manual labor, according to the report. It notes that many people surveyed said they felt better off because of the work opportunities created by the camp's existence. Alex Garcia says an important opportunity revealed through the research is that interventions that would equip locals with skills and technical support that improve agricultural and livestock production could in turn be widely beneficial to the surrounding community as well as the refugee population.
The poverty rate of the local population is 94%. So, and in many cases, if you look at what households purchase and consume, you would observe that the local people are poorer than the refugees. And so the fact that they get this opportunity to engage in a different form of production, I think is really interesting and has a lot of potential. I think that a creative policymaker or development organization could go in and support some of those activities for the host population.
Researchers caution that the data shows average effects and vary by gender. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. There is some good news for people in Juba. Passports and IDs are being processed once again. Find out more when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you ever treat yourself to something special? What is that and why?
I really like food, so anytime I want to treat myself to something special, I get a nice meal and a drink and I just have fun.
Oh no, I don't treat myself to something special because I see it as waste of time and waste of income.
Giving yourself a treat, I see it as a healthy something because if you do that, you release some stress, maybe you are bored. By so doing, you get rid of those bonus.
I do so because it depends on how much I've spent and how I've struggled to get what I've achieved in life. That's why I do so. I can go out with friends, I can go in for drinks.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan government officials are back in the business of printing passports and national identity cards. The government halted the service for 1 month. The head of the Directorate of Nationality, Passports and Immigration says the services were stopped temporarily due to what he calls a technical problem. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of South Sudanese nationals queue at the premises of the Directorate of Nationality, Passports and Immigration to submit their applications for passports and national identity cards. Lieutenant General Majak Akech, Director General for Nationality, Passports and Immigration, told the reporters at a news conference this morning that the computer system and its software have been fixed.
It was a technical problem in the machines whereby the network was not actually communicating to one another. There was a problem, a technical errors in the machines, but we have managed to solve them.
Akech denies the government stopped producing passports and national ID cards after it failed to pay $500,000 to a German company to repair the computer system. But 2 weeks ago, Brigadier General Daniel Justin, a spokesman for the Interior Ministry, told the South Sudan in Focus that passport production was halted after the German company Maba Group, which was contracted to fix the system after it broke down, demanded for more money.
Our Directorate of NPI, Nationality Passport and Immigration, they have contracted a company, German company. He's the one managing the software of our passports, immigration and all the IDs, okay? Then they were claiming they have some arrears not paid. Later on, they decided just to stop the service right away from there.
The Maba Group, the German company, declined to comment for this story. Akech says his ministry will process documents for applicants as quickly as possible.
Whenever you don't get your passport in a day, then make sure that we'll be working day and night to make sure that you get your documents. Then for us as a directorate, we'll not even enjoy the Christmas of this year because of this issue. We'll be even working until Saturday.
Jaden Powell was queuing up this morning at the premises of the nationality cards, along with the hundreds of others to apply for a national ID card. Powell says he began the application process in September, but could not finish after the computer system broke down.
Now I'm very happy because I'm now running my process of the card.
Daniel Alphonse, director of Meridi State Health Ministry, says he traveled all the way from Meridi to renew his passport several weeks ago. He says he would rather be working at home, but decided to wait in Juba until the government resolved its computer problems.
As a government employee, the system, the place I work, of course, is lacking me behind there. There is a breakdown in between here. Because for me, as a government employee, I should be in my place of work and do other things, not standing like this in the queue and so on.
Alphonse urged government officials to improve services at the directorate and to ensure that it provides adequate shelter and seats for the hundreds of applicants waiting their turn to get their documents processed. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Kampala, where Ugandans living with HIV/AIDS are concerned about the persistent shortage of antiretroviral drugs. Since July, the government has failed to adequately provide ARVs for the 1 million Ugandans who need them. Some patients have been given an alternative medication, while others have to make journeys to health centers weekly to get drugs. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
In Uganda, nearly 1.5 million people live with HIV/AIDS, and all about perhaps 500,000 are on antiretroviral treatments. That includes retired soldier Major Rubalamira Ruranga.
I have been living with HIV for 32 years. There is no real cure for HIV. But there are medications in the name of ARVs which can help us to live on. And those medications really work very effectively. Because I'm sure if they were not there, I wouldn't be alive today. And I'm as normal as any other man.
However, HIV/AIDS patients are facing a tough time ahead and are worried they could die as shortages of antiretroviral drugs or ARVs persist. Daniel Kawoya is one such patient.
Our health workers told us that we can only survive when we are taking ARVs. Without ARVs, we are dead.
Margaret Happy is a communication and advocacy officer at the International Community of Women Living with HIV. She explains some of those ARVs that are in short supply in Uganda's hospitals.
Some of the ARVs that have been out of stock since June are Abacavir, Atenolizumab, Nevirapine for pediatrics, Lopinavir for pediatrics, Tenofovir, Lamivudine, and Efavirenz. This is actually a combination which is given out also for the mothers.
The Uganda AIDS Commission blames the shortage of ARVs on the increased enrollment of people needing them. This follows the introduction of the test and treat policy, where each person who tests positive to HIV is put on treatment. The former policy required that only patients whose so-called helper cells, called CD4s, drop below a given level. The new approach drops that requirement. CD4s are an indication of the health of an individual's immune system and its ability to suppress the HIV virus that causes AIDS. Dr. Carol Nakazi is the head of HIV prevention at Uganda AIDS Commission. She says the budget for the ARV drugs has remained the same despite the introduction of the new policy.
We had projected ARVs for the other guidelines, but with test and treat now we are having shortages. The other guidelines we used to say that the people would put on drugs should have a CD4 below 500. By the new guidelines, test and treat says give ARVs whoever tests positive irrespective of their CD4 count.
Today, more than 330,000 more people are receiving HIV treatment than the 728,000 counted 2 years ago. Health workers warn that the shortage of the ARVs is likely to create drug resistance, which is way more expensive to handle and thus increased number of HIV/AIDS-related deaths. Dr. John Sally is the National Medical Director with Uganda Cares, a non-government organization handling people living with HIV.
Risks are high that patients might not even take for the 2 weeks because they are not sure of the tomorrow. They'll end up developing resistance, and resistance leads to failure. The virus will partially be suppressed, and as a result, a patient can end up succumbing to death.
Esther Mbayo is Uganda's Minister of the Presidency. She acknowledges that the issue of drug shortages needs to be addressed urgently.
There is inadequate supply. For example, somebody who has been getting the ARVs on a monthly basis is encouraged to receive for only 1 week and then he goes back. So now that inconvenience of going back four times in a month is what is causing all that problem. But we are working around the clock as government to ensure that there is restocking with immediate effect.
The test and treat policy is part of the campaign by the World Health Organization. It aims to have 90% of the people living with HIV in the world know their HIV status, and for 90% of those diagnosed with HIV to receive sustainable antiretroviral therapy. Finally, the policy calls for 90% of those infected to have a suppressed viral load by 2020. Experts warn that government of Uganda might not achieve the target if it does not increase HIV/AIDS funding. Uganda only contributes 7% to AIDS financing, with 93% of the budget coming from donations. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
That report by Catherine Nambi from Kampala brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Koneta Nan Bura by the Freedom Boys.
You could have kuna gage, koneta nangura. Muju could have kuna tupet, koneta nangura. Muju could have kuna lomeri, koneta nangura. Wa lele, koneta nangura. Woo lulu, koneta nangura. Domo nelio, koneta nangura. Domo tenio.
We have been listening to Freedom Boys with the song Koneta Nan Bora. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We'd like to know what you think about our show. You can reach us at southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us on our Facebook site, that's South Sudan in Focus. Remember to be with us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Ila jamesi ngudu di bango jambu.
Mugonyutaran, Baba, for the Queen. He jumped on your mess.